Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
We're back talking World Football League with author and historian Mark Speck as we continue our visit in the pig pen to take that rock down memory lane of the World Football League of the mid-1970s. This is part two of our look at the WFL with Mark, and Mark is going to get more into the 1974 inaugural season and the events and players that took place in that season. It's coming up for you in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com. You're once again in the pig pen, your portal to positive football history. And in the pig pen, we are going to pick up on a conversation we had recently with Mark Speck, an author of multiple books. I think there's five or six of them and two in the cooker here for the World Football League that took place in the 1970s. And in part one of our series, if you haven't listened to it yet, might not be a bad idea to check that out first. It just happened a couple days ago. First aired it on Monday, May 23rd, so just a couple days old. But we talked about the origin story in the preseason leading up to the 1974 inaugural season of the WFL in 1974. And now in this episode, we're going to talk more about the 1974 season with Mark Speck, author of some great books on St. Johann Press. Near the end, we're going to give some specs to where you can get some of his books. It's also in the show notes. We'd like to have your feedback, pigskindispatch@gmail.com. And now, here's our further conversation with author and historian Mark Speck.
Now you got the NFL on notice. You got the fans got their attention by saying, hey, these guys are got some the money here to sign these players. We might want to pay attention. So, and again, because of the fact that the NFL felt like they were being robbed, not only did Cincinnati, but also Dallas, and I think another team had restraining orders put out. You can't sign any more of our players, even at these future contracts. And the league was off to what I thought was a fairly good start. I mean, you know, you had these teams moving around a little bit, but, you know, they had signed some big name players. They had coaches that, you know, were well-known. Tom Fears was a Hall of Famer. He was a coach of the Sun. Ron Mix was the general manager. He's a Hall of Famer. He was the general manager for the Portland Storm. Ron Waller had been around. He is an NFL, former NFL player and a coach. He was the Philadelphia coach. And some of them had good stadiums. The Jacksonville had Gator Bowl, which was 70,000. Memphis had Memorial Stadium. It sat about 50,000. They had a lot of entertainers that were interested in the team. Elvis went to almost all the games. He surprised Bassett one day by asking Bassett for his autograph. Elvis asked Bassett for his autograph. Bassett's like, I wanted his autograph. But, you know, you had him, you had Isaac Hayes, who, you know, sang the song Shaft, had some hits back in the 70s. He was there all the time. He invested some money. Charlie Rich, who the country singer, Behind Closed Doors and Most Beautiful Girl in the Whole World. He invested in it. So it was looking pretty good. The league started in July. The crowds were good. Like I said, Birmingham had 50,000. On the first Thursday night game, Jacksonville drew 64,000. So, I mean, it's looking good. The crowds are good, 30,000, 40,000. And in about August, beginning of August, word really started to leak out that some of these crowds they had papered the house. They had given away tickets either free or at a discount just to make it look good. So it turns out they had, Philadelphia was the worst of them. They had 55,000 in their first game. 64,000 in their second game. It turns out the crowds were actually 6,000 and 13,000. That's who paid full price for their tickets. Everybody else was either free or had gotten a deep discount for their tickets. The one of the vice presidents, Barry Lieb of the Bell, said, "I didn't think those figures would get out. You know, I didn't know a reporter was a priest, you know." And but he was the one basically got his, you know, his head was on the block after that, because, you know, I mean, this was, you're talking, I mean, you know, everybody gives out free tickets in every sport. You know, you've got a crowd of 20,000, you give away maybe 2,000 tickets. But this was like the complete opposite. They'd made it an art form here in the WFL. So then it turns out they weren't the only culprits. You had Jacksonville, who had given away of their 100,000 of their first two games, was like 40,000 were free. So they were found guilty of it. Birmingham had inflated their crowds. A couple other teams had. So the whole league looked bad. And to me, it was called Papergate because papering the house. Some guy, I think one of the reporters from Philadelphia, Dolson, I think it was, came up with the name Papergate because of the, you know, everything back then was gate because of Watergate. So they called it Papergate. Some people called it Sugargate because it was all these promotions were through Domino Sugar. And that's where they got all the free tickets. So it was either Papergate. It was mainly known as Papergate. And to me, in my opinion, and I don't know what else other people think, but I think right then and there, the WFL died. It just, nobody was going to believe them. Their credibility was shot. They were giving away tickets. Like, what's his name? The guy that wrote for the Sporting News. He did the column every week. And he said, this shows all those people that didn't think the WFL could give tickets away. Well, obviously they were. So, and if they weren't giving tickets away, the crowds were just off. Hawaii was around 15,000. Detroit was around 10,000. Portland, they started out fairly good, maybe 20,000. But after, you know, after the first couple of crowds, that's what Philadelphia did. They were around 6,000, 15,000 until they got to the game in October where it was raining. It was awful weather. And they wound up with a 100,000 seat stadium. They wound up with 750 people. And I've seen the photograph of it, and it I don't even know if it's 750. But yeah, so I think right then and there, Darren, that was the end of it. That was, I mean, they kept going for another year till 75, but nobody was going to believe them after that. It was just their credibility was shot.
Mark, was that their only form of revenue, was the tickets, or did they have a television contract?
They did get a television contract. They weren't going to get with any of the big networks at the time. NBC, CBS, ABC were locked in with the NFL. They weren't going to get into them. They wound up getting it with, I don't know if you remember, the TVS network. They carried a lot of college basketball. And it was an independent station. Eddie Einhorn, who wound up running the Chicago White Sox in the 80s, was a president. They signed a deal. They didn't make hardly any money off of it. Einhorn said it was a good sell at the beginning. You know, when things were looking good, when they were signing players like Zonka, Kick, and Warfield, and other big names like Morton and Stabler. And, you know, and it was the novelty of it. It was a good sell. The advertisers were buying it. They were snapping up time, you know, advertising time. So they made a lot of money at the beginning. And then once that Papergate hit, Einhorn said they didn't sell a dime in advertising time after that, not one rest of the season. And because nobody believed them. So they were on TVS. You had Merle Harmon doing the play-by-play and Alex Hawkins, the old Baltimore Colt. And I think he played for the Falcons for a while. Great guy, had a great sense of humor. So he's good for the color commentary. Came up with some great quotes for the WFL in his one book, Then Came Brain Damage. If you haven't read it, read it. He's got like, I think, two chapters devoted to the WFL. Just what they went through. They told the truck to go to Kansas City, which was in the middle of the country, because they didn't know where they're going to be playing from week to week. and what game they were going to be airing. So, okay, well, go to Portland. No, let's go to Philadelphia this week. We're going to Jackson. So because they were in Kansas City, the center of the country, is easier to go. And, you know, they had a couple of guys that basically lived in the truck, a couple of the cameramen. But, you know, they had those two guys. They were professionals. Murrow had been around for years. Hawkins was great. He had you know, a great football knowledge. He was funny. And then he would have a guest announcer every week. They had a different guy. The first guy was George Plimpton. They had Burt Reynolds 1 week, I think a couple of weeks. Paul Hornung was on a couple of weeks. Rosie Greer was on 1 week. They did have a lady by the name of Jane Chastain. I don't know if you remember her. She went to the NFL. Well, she was the first woman to announce a football game, and it was in the WFL. So she went there, and then after she went, you know, guested on the WFL on the TBS, the NFL snapped her up, and she went on to, I think it was CBS then, and hired her, and she went in to be an announcer there. So you had all these guest announcers. Some of them knew football. Some of them just, you know, guys that were interesting and big stars just to get people to watch. McLean Stevenson, who had been on MASH, was on 1 week. Jack Kemp, who was in politics at the time. So you had, you know, big names there. And, you know, but they just didn't sell enough money. I think, their payout was awful at the end of the year. It was nowhere near what it was going to be. So they didn't get much money at all. So, yeah, that didn't help them at all. So, again, you know, with these teams suffering at the gate and also papering the house, things were looking really bad. Detroit wound up folding. They just, you know, they tried to find some investors for it. Upton Bell, Burt Bell's son, he was going to buy them, move them to Charlotte. He was all set to do that. John DeLorean was involved, the guy that was had the DeLorean car that was in Back to the Future. He was going to buy the team, but he was going to keep it in Detroit. Upton Bell was going to move it to Charlotte. But Upton lost interest when he found out they had to pay all their debts back, which were significant. And he wasn't crazy enough to do that. So he wound up buying the New York Stars and moving them to Charlotte. And they were a better team anyway. Detroit wound up folding. Jacksonville, because they had papered the house, they did fairly well financially, but the team was terrible. They won 4 games and lost 10. Their attendance dropped as the season went along. So they folded. Couldn't find anybody to buy them, even though Dick Butkus went in and he had a check, certified check. He was going to buy the team. They said that they had an amount that here's a down payment. He had the check. Well, they decided they wanted more than that. And they didn't want him in. And I don't know why they turned down money, but he was all set to buy it. And they turned him down. So they wound up both folding. They had a dispersal draft for Detroit. Like I said, New York moved to Charlotte. Houston couldn't draw. They started out fairly well. Again, like most of them, the novelty kind of wore off really quick. So their crowds went down. They wound up looking for some place to play. Steve Arnold was running out of what little money he had. They finally found some guys in Shreveport, Louisiana, who wanted to buy the team. So they moved there in September. So there's another team that moved. He had two teams moving. And then again, Charlie Vincent, who was the guy that was writing the sporting news article on the WFL that talked about it every week. He goes, when they asked me where I thought the teams were going to finish in 74, I didn't know that meant geographically. You know, he thought he was just going to say 1, 2, 3, 4, who's going to finish first, second, third. Cause I didn't know that meant, you know, geographically, that I was going to have to figure out where they were going to finish. You have teams folding, you have teams struggling. The Lions are doing terrible. Portland's doing awful, but you had a couple of teams like those two who actually turned it around in the second half of the season because they both started signing NFL players. Hawaii added Ben Clements, who played for the Giants. They had Randy Johnson, the quarterback. He did great. Ed Hargett was another quarterback. I think he's from the Saints. They signed him. So they got a lot of these guys to Portland. They signed Ben Davidson, the old Raider, to come in and play. Jerry Inman, Steve Thompson, Rick Redmond, who was a pretty good middle linebacker for the Chargers. And they changed the name of the defense to the Stormfront because they really started playing very well. They got Pete Bethert to be their quarterback. So they turned both those teams turned it around, but they were still struggling financially. They made it to the end of the season. And then, you know, usually the playoffs are the time when, you know, you celebrate, you've got the teams you've got set that are going to be in the playoffs. Well, the WFL decided to change their playoff format about 8 times in about a week. They had 8 teams, then they had 6 teams, then they had 5 teams, and they had, you know, then they were going to have Memphis and Birmingham play, and then the winner would play Florida for the World Bowl. And then Southern California, who won the Western Division, wasn't even involved. And they said, why even have divisions if you're not going to include us? We won a division championship. So they wound up having two first-round games. Philadelphia played at Florida. It was actually supposed to be Charlotte, because Charlotte finished ahead of Philadelphia in the standings. But Charlotte had no money. They couldn't even pay to get their team down to Florida. So they had to cancel that game that Philadelphia said they'd play, even though they finished with the worst record. And Florida won. In the other first-round game, you had Hawaii playing Southern California. Everybody thought Southern California would win, where the Hawaiians upset them. A couple of their Southern California players had boycotted the game because they hadn't been paid for about 5 weeks. So they boycotted the game. That hurt them. So then it was Hawaii against Birmingham. That was a good game, 22-19 in the next round. And then everybody thought Memphis was going to beat Florida. They had won 17 out of 20 games. So the game was in Memphis. They wound up getting a 15-0 lead at halftime. They knocked Bob Davis, Florida's quarterback, out of the game. They said, well, this is over. Well, Florida came back, scored 18 points in the second half. They had Buddy Palazzo, who was a rookie quarterback, who had played like 5 games for the team. I think he had attempted like 5 or 6 passes. Pardee said, just go in and run the ball, throw when you have to. Let's just go in there. And they started running sweeps. They wound up beating them 18-15, blocked a field goal at the end of the game to clinch the win. Florida was upset because they thought they had the whole thing set up for Memphis and Birmingham to play in the World Bowl, because they were the two best teams, according to NA, best financially. And so Pardee, again, like George Allen, played the underdog role, the psychological, we're the underdogs, nobody likes us, we're, you know, downtrodden, all that kind of thing. They're emphasizing these other teams, and, you know, they're getting all the advantages and we're not. And Pardee, he was a great psychologist. He could play that, and these guys hadn't been paid since, like, September. It was like the last 13 weeks of the season. They got a couple of checks from the league, and I think they made a beer commercial, and they got like $200 for that. And the guys they're crying. They're so happy to get money. Mike McBath, I talked to him and interviewed him, and he said, I just remember them, the repo man, repossessing the cars in the parking lot at halftime during the games. They would just go in and just take the cars because they weren't paying. You know, Jack Pardee went in, his wife went into a grocery store to buy groceries. She handed a guy a $20 bill, and the guy's looking at it like maybe it was counterfeit. You know, and he followed her home and took the groceries back because he didn't think that the money was real. So, you know, the guys couldn't get their cars fixed. They couldn't pay their bills. Same way with Detroit. Guys were moving in together. Bubba Wyche moved in with about 3 or 4 other players and one of the assistant coaches. And they lived together just to save money to try to get through. Families moved together because in case the team decided to move, it'd be easier for them to move. So, yeah, it was just – you know, New York, again, they had to move to Charlotte because they didn't get any crowds at all. They were down to like 4 digits, 6,000, 4,000, that kind of thing. Nobody was coming to see them. The team was fairly good. They were at 10-6 at one point. They had a lot of the old Jets playing for them, Jerry Philbin, John Elliott, George Sauer. And, you know, so they were a fairly decent team. They had, you know, some good quarterback, and Bob Gladjoe, who I think is – his top total rushing for a season was 171 yards, actually set the league record at one point with 161 yards in one game after he'd rushed in one season for 171 yards. So he was having a pretty good year, but then he got a really bad leg injury, missed the last few games. But, you know, they were a fairly good team. They went to Charlotte, got a really good welcome. They got good crowds. City really welcomed them, but then he lost their last 4 games when he got down there and, you know, finished 10-10. Philadelphia, they had King Cochran, who was one of the great characters in pro football. He had a fairly good year, but, you know, he's one of those uncoachable guys that he thought he knew more than anybody else did. And then at the last game, Chicago didn't want to play. Orager had said, that's it, I'm done. I'm not playing any more football games. We're going to forfeit our last game against Philadelphia. Well, Cochran had like these bonuses in his contract that if he threw for so many touchdowns, so many yards, he would get these bonuses. Well, now he's not going to play the last game. He's played 19 games. He goes, he's going in the office, find somebody to play. I don't care who it is. Let's find somebody to play. I want, you know, let's play another game. And, you know, so, but he was a character. They had a fairly good team. They had a crazy offense that Ron Waller had, not the triple I, but they had a quadruple I. They had four guys behind the quarterback. They had all these formations that they ran. It was a very entertaining team, kind of like the Pottstown team, the minor league team that they all played on. And they were an entertaining team, if nothing else. Southern California had a great team. They had Tony Adams, who was a rookie, came in from Utah State, had a fantastic year, very good quarterback. He wound up being one of the co-MVPs. Memphis had John Ewart, who had won the Heisman Trophy, signed him. They had Danny White, who wound up going to the Cowboys. They had those two quarterbacks. They were set there. Their running game was awesome. They had, I think, if they hadn't had injuries, they probably would have had three running backs who would have rushed for 1,000 yards. I mean, that's how good they were. They had John Harvey. They had Willie Spencer. And they had another guy. His name escapes me right now at the moment. But they had three guys who were just, you know, they had a ground game that was like Patton in the Second World War. They won 17 games. They were a great team. They had Ed Marshall, who had played in the NFL. He wound up having the most touchdowns, led the league in scoring. Had a good defensive backfield, good defense overall. They were a great team. And, you know, they had John McVay as the head coach. And McVay, he was the head coach of the Giants at the time with the miracle in Meadowlands when they had the Sargic fumbled the football and Herman Edwards picked it up. That lost him his job, as well as Bob Gibson, who was one of his assistants. But McVay went on in the 80s to help put together the San Francisco 49ers dynasty. As a front office person, he was executive of the year for the Sporting News 1 year where they won the Super Bowl. So, I mean, he had a lot of players and coaches that were good. Just that whole idea of the paper gate just hanging over them, I think just really killed them. That I don't think anything was, you know, like I said, they didn't sell any advertising time. After that happened, crowds went down, and then they got rid of Davidson. Rodgers said, I can't work with this guy. I'm tired of him. And at the end of October, there's still a conflict, whether he resigned or whether he's booted out. Nobody really knows the story. Davidson said he resigned. The other guy said he kicked him out. So they got rid of him toward the end of the season and the end of October. So it was just a perfect storm of just bad luck, bad management, some, you know, just bad credibility. Just a lot of things just went wrong. Just, you know, it was a bad economy. The economy was terrible at that time. The Dow Jones took a nosedive. They had what they called stagflation. It was stagnant. It was a kind of a stagnant economy and inflation, so they called it stagflation. He just had a real perfect storm of all these things that went wrong at the same time that I think if the league would have just, you know, maybe had a little bit better management. Davidson himself admits that he didn't even vet any of the owners. Very few of them. He had a guy from Detroit named Bud Huckle, who was a hospital employee, who said, well, you know, I've been doing all this legwork and I own, you know, I should have a part of the team. But he wound up suing. He got booted out. He had the original owner of the Philadelphia team was Kent Bogdanoff, who was an out-of-work lifeguard. He was going to put up the $25,000. And a friend was going to put up $25,000. And his friend wound up dropping out. Bogdanoff said, I've got $25,000. That's it. And, you know, they said, okay, well, we'll give you I think they gave him a front office job somewhere. I can't remember which team it was. So, you know, it was just the idea that in a lot of instances, Davidson just, okay, you got a couple of nickels to rub together. You know, let's get you in here. You know, as John Bassett said, you know, we're going up to Detroit to play a game, and I don't know what the situation is there. But what I understand, they got 33 guys that put in 15 cents each in to run the team. And that became a joke around the league because they had, you know, 33 owners. It really wasn't 33 owners as much as it was 33 investors. And they didn't have that strong central figure that could really run things and make these decisions. These people were all good business people at their own business. You know, you had funeral directors, you had bankers, you had all these different kind of executives. You had Esther Edwards, who was the vice president of Motown Records. You had Marvin Gaye, the singer, entertainer. Mike Ilitch, when he was really, this is basically when he was just starting out with, you know, Little Caesars, was still kind of a small time thing at the time, but he was involved. And you had 33 people who basically at every one of their weekly meetings, they go, I don't know, what do you want to do? Well, I don't know, what do you want to do? Well, I don't know, what do you want to do? Well, let's just not do anything. So it's like, yeah, they come out, well, we have no decisions for me. So, you know, guys aren't getting paid. The off front office people aren't getting paid. The crowds are terrible. I think that if they would have had that strong central figure, you know, like I said, all sports teams have investors. You know, they don't have just one guy. You don't, very seldom do you have one guy. You know, Al Davis ran the Raiders, but he had investors. But he made the decisions. Ralph Wilson with the Bills, Jerry Jones, they've got investors with the Cowboys. But they have that guy that, you know, makes those decisions where their meetings don't just, degenerate into, I don't know, what do you want to do? I don't know, should we pay the players? I don't know. Should we pay the front office? I don't know. So that's basically what happened with them. And, you know, so it was just the idea that you had 33 people who were good business people at what they did, but they had no football experience, no sports experience. They wound up saying that they could just pay, they paid training camp expenses out of pocket. They didn't have like a set rate that they sent, you know, and paid for it up front. So they really didn't know what they're doing. And one guy said, well, you know, they were trying to look for a place to hold the training camp. They're discussing all these different places. And the one guy said, well, let's have them out on Belle Isle. It was like a, you know, island there in the Detroit River that, you know, was a park and had all these places to go. Yeah, we'll put them out on the, on Belle Isle, and we'll have them in tents. And they'll be like camping out and they'll have fun. And they're like, well, how are these guys going to eat? How are they going to bathe? Oh, well, I guess I didn't think of that. You know, so, you know, and that, of course, you know, with these newspapers, they're going to pick up on all this stuff. The NFL is going to pick up on all this stuff. The NFL, it's just like McDonald's is not going to advertise the Whopper. You know, they're not going to put any kind of good word in on the WFL. They're a rival. They're signing their players. They're taking away their coaches. They're moving into their cities. They don't want anything to do with these guys. So they're, any little story they picked up on. The Papergate scandal came about because Leonard Toews, the owner of the Eagles, sent one of his office people down to the tax office to see how much the taxes were, because that's how you told how much the tickets, you know, how much tickets were sold, was to see how much taxes they would have to pay. Well, they found out that, so, you know, the NFL, but, you know, it's war. NFL, you know, it was just like with the AFL, the NFL, WHA with the NHL, the ABA with the NBA. You're not going to help these guys, you know, you're not going to.
Definitely don't want to help your competition. That's for sure. Now, Mark, I guess you got a few books out on the WFL. Do you want to give us the titles of those and where folks can find those at?
A book on the Blazers is called In a Dollar Short. You can buy them at Amazon. You can get it through the St. Johann Press. If you contact them, I've got a friend, Richie Franklin. I don't know if you know Richie or not. He's a big WFL collector, WFL historian, basically has kept the WFL in the public consciousness for the last 40 years, having reunions, organizing reunions. He has a website, and what he does is if you mention the website, you'll get the shipping waived, and you won't have to pay shipping on it. If you mention, I know Richie Franklin's website, okay, if you get it through St. Johann Press. There was, and A Dollar Short was the Blazers book. Then I had Wiffle, which was a kind of history of the entire league, again, through Amazon, St. Johann Press. Then I did a book on a minor league team, Central Pennsylvania Whitetail Bucks, which was really one of the books I'm proudest of. And the guys that I interviewed were great. And again, that's Amazon and St. Johann. And then I got an idea to do a Detroit book, did a book on the Wheels, just the set of flat tires. The Wheels were just a set of flat tires. That was the title of it. And it's again through Amazon and St. Johann Press. And now I've got a book on the San Antonio Wings that's supposed to be coming out soon, called On a Wing and a Prayer. Still not out yet. We're working on the cover art. The book's all written. It's all set to go in. And then at the present time, I'm working on an update on the WFL Encyclopedia, which Todd and I had done. And that's going to be huge. It's going to be, I've been working on it for years already. And I'm working with my editor, and we've been working on it for over a year already, just getting stuff updated. The player register took us 3 months in itself. So we got that done. Now we're about halfway through 75. And my wife is getting me the phone here with the Amazon. Nothing but a brand new set of flat tires. A sad, sorry saga of the Detroit wheels, of the 74 Detroit wheels. So thank you, Elise. She's the brains of the outfit. That's why I've got but yeah.
Hey, we all need those, that's for sure.
Yeah. So yeah, like I said, the San Antonio book is going to be On a Wing and a Prayer. It's going to be the WFL Encyclopedia, probably second edition. It's going to, like I said, I have got so many new things on it, new sections, trivia. I've got recollections with some of the players, coaches, fans, researchers talking about their experience with the league. Some of it good, some of it bad. And then there's an assistant coach register, cities that didn't make the WFL. There's a whole list of those. Some of the cities that were rumored to be in the league, some of the cities that almost got a team. That's quite a list. Some of the guys who went on to play in the movies in Hollywood and on TV and wrestling. There's all kind of things, a whole section about the future contracts, talking about that, all the players that signed. It's just a whole list of things that I'm adding on to it. I don't know if it all get in. It's probably going to be humongous if it does. I'm not sure if Dave's going to want to put everything in there. I hope he does. There's going to be a chronology, which has transactions, injury reports, things that happen, milestones, different happenings in the league. That's up to about 200 and some pages already itself. So that's going to be in there. There's just a lot of good stuff in there. But yeah, mostly all the books are available through Amazon. And if you go through St. Johann Press, just remember to mention Richie Franklin's website on the WFL, and they'll waive the shipping charge for you. So yeah, those are the ones that are out now. And then again, two of them are in process. They sell well. The encyclopedia sells well. The Wiffle book sells well. All of them do. I'm very happy with it, how they sell. Dave is very happy with it, my publisher. So there's still an interest out there. I mean, we've got the other league group in Facebook, World Football League group, World Football League cards. They're selling cards now. Whole sets of cards that are really well made and well done by Richie. Again, that's another thing he's involved in. And a couple other guys that have been around. So it's really something that you wouldn't think would still be around and still be of an interest to people, but it is. And the books do get good reviews. A lot of the people have their remembrances when they write their reviews. Oh, I was a season ticket holder for the Sun. I remember going to the games. It was great. And some of them were fans. So, you know, I really am amazed. Like I said, when I started out in the 80s, I thought I'm the only guy doing this. Nobody else is interested in this league. Lasted a year and a half, lost $30 million. But it's amazing how it's just still stuck in the public consciousness. You know, and the NFL finally picked up on the action point. They use it now. And a lot of the same rules that the WFL put in 74, the NFL adopted. It's amazing. To me, it's just amazing that people still buy them. People are still interested in it. There's still guys that, you know, I talk to on Facebook that I can't wait for your next book. How about doing one on this team? How about doing one on this team? I said, well, I'd love to do one on every team if I could. It's just getting my publisher to want to do it. So it's just, it's not, you know, it's not a my decision. I'd write a book on every team, you know, and do that. But, you know, you've got to talk him into it, and which is normal. He knows publishing. He knows what people buy. You know, he knows what people are interested in. He likes slice of life things. He goes, I don't want another book on the Yankees. There's 15,000 books on the Yankees. Why do I want another book on the Yankees or Penn State or, you know, any of these teams that have been around and are still available? for study and research. He goes, I want these leagues that lasted like a certain period of time, like the American Basketball League in the early 60s. He's put out a couple of books about that. You know, it's amazing to me that, that people are still interested in it. I'm happy about it, obviously, because, you know, the books sell. But it amazes me that so many people are still interested in it. But it's a great story. I mean, there's a human interest story there. There's a sports story. There's a business story. I mean, these guys went through a lot of hardships. One thing I'll never do is denigrate the players. I'll talk a lot about the owners and some of the other stuff that went on. But players, they went in there just because of the love of football. They didn't care if they weren't getting paid. And, you know, the Florida Blazers was one example of that. They won 14 games and lost six, won the Eastern Division title, hadn't been paid in the last 13 weeks. But they kept going on and winning games. Jack Pardee just kept telling them, hey, I don't know if you're going to get paid or not, but let's go ahead and keep playing, keep winning and see what we can do. And they followed him. They were loyal. They loved him. Every guy I talked to, they loved the guy. They couldn't say enough good about him, that he was in there. And again, it was like a lot of the psychology, a lot of the idea of, you know, how he could make it look like, well, we're the underdogs and everybody else is above us. But, you know, he was really an amazing coach. And, you know, they had Ken Crippen posted in the PFRA group there, and he said, you know, who's your favorite all-time coach? And I said Pardee. You know, I always rooted for him after that, you know, where he was at Houston, where he's at for the Oilers, he was for the Gamblers in the USFL, for the CFL in college. I just thought he was a great guy, and everybody I've talked to say the same thing. Just, you know, he brought stability to that franchise. They were in Washington, they were in Annapolis, they were in Baltimore, Norfolk, they got to Orlando. And they hired him, and the team just settled down. He was in there and he knew what he was doing, and having, you know, all the experience as far as being a player, a front office coach. And he couldn't have, you know, they couldn't have asked for a better person to hire as far as I'm concerned.
Sounds like it's a great league. I mean, the legacy just lingers on, like you said, and you know, a lot of people are still talking about the WFL, and we appreciate it. It's folks like you that are writing about it and keeping and preserving a great era of professional football, even though it lasted a little bit, but it provided so much entertainment and actually a lot of, you know, great things came out of it, because I think it really pushed the NFL to new heights by having new competition. And we appreciate your time coming on and talking about this, and hope to talk to you again real soon. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Darren. I really appreciate you having me on talking about my favorite subject. I love researching it. Every day I'm finding something new, something I didn't know, and that's what I love. And it's a labor of love, because it's not even work to me. And I love being retired. That's what I do all day. But, you know, it's a great thing. We haven't even touched on 75 yet. So, you know, if you want to have me on again, be glad to do that and talk about the second year.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah. Thank you, Darren.
That's all the football history we have today, folks. Join us back tomorrow for more of your football history. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts. It's found right here on the Sports History Network.